This is a Suno India production and you're listening to the Suno India Show.
In 2001, the literacy rate among Muslims was 60%, approximately 5 percentage points below the national average then. Muslims who are graduates or hold diplomas were only 4%. 3 percentage points below the national average in 2001. This was recorded in the Sachar Committee report. The Prime Minister's office set up this committee, headed by Justice Rajinder Sachar, to prepare a report on the social, economic and educational status of the Muslim community in India. The report was submitted in 2006. Wait, why are we talking about this? Because the report's observations are prescient even today, especially when Muslim hijabi girls are being told that they have to remove their hijab before entering classrooms in Karnataka.
No. Enough is enough. Uniform without with ID card, much other mobile tharing. More options with the burden.
Here, the hijabi girls from Davangere are asking people at the gate of their college to let them come in. They plead, "We can't remove the hijab, sir." The person at the gate says that he cannot allow them in because the rules have come from the head office. And this is happening in many places in Karnataka. While the Karnataka High Court is hearing petitions by some students seeking the removal of this rule, students are asking the state government to postpone their practical exams pending the hearing of the case. Okay, getting back to the Sachar Committee report. As I said, it's prescient. More than 15 years ago, when girls and women were asked about education, they told the committee members that they want it. Here's what the report says.
There is one big ray of hope. While the education system appears to have given up on Muslim girls, the girls themselves have not given up on education.
In fact, the surveys conducted after more than a decade of the publication of the Sachar Committee report indicate that the number of Muslim women and girls enrolling in schools and colleges across the country is rising. Hi, I'm Menaka Rao, the host of this episode of the Suno India Show. This is the second episode in the two-part series on the hijab Rao. In this episode, I spoke to Dr. Saba Hussain, Assistant Professor in Education and Social Justice at the University of Birmingham in the UK. She has conducted research on school-going Muslim girls in Assam and has studied how they are perceived by different players in the educational system, from policymakers to the teachers. She spoke to the most important stakeholder of all in this scenario, the Muslim girl student herself. A book on this research was published in 2019 called Contemporary Muslim Girlhoods in India, A Study of Social Justice, Identity and Agency in Assam. She spoke to me about her research first.
I'll tell you by starting a little bit about my research, I think, and that does sort of, reflect on this issue quite a bit. But I must also clarify that I did my research between the fieldwork of it, at least between 2013 and 14 in Assam. So that is slightly different, but the conversations and the terms of the conversation are very similar. And even before I did my research in Assam, I used to be a social development consultant in India. So I've worked in Karnataka, Bengal, Rajasthan, and, various parts of India. In fact, I was in Udupi for a research at one point before. And one of the things, and that's what got me interested into writing this doctoral project later, was that when it comes to Muslim girls, it is as though people are speaking in very, very, very different terms. And obviously, we don't hear Muslim girls' voices. And potentially, there is that, the reluctance to hear Muslim girls' voices as well. So when I was, when I was a researcher in India, long before I did this research on Muslim girls' education, one of the things I used to work on was education and access to education and things like that in general. And every time we would meet government officials and we would ask them questions about, what about minorities? What about minorities' access to education? one thing that consistently came out was, well, they don't want education for their girls. They just want to get, marry them off early. And, you know, minorities are not interested in education. So, you know, we spend these resources on other things which might have a better result for us, right? So that was often the stance we got from policymakers on the ground, often from teachers as well. But when I spoke to people, Muslim parents and, you know, people who had children in school or had young families, they would often talk about challenges of sending their children to school. They wouldn't talk about any inherent opposition to education. It was very common sense that for you to do better, for, you know, you to have any sort of better life, education is a must. There wasn't, you know, any gray areas, even for the parents. Yes, what education, where, in what terms, all of that was always, you know, different for different families. But the fact that education was essential wasn't something many people were debating. They had concerns about access to schooling, how their children were treated in schools, how, you know, and other things which not just Muslim parents had, all other parents had concerns about having safe drinking water, toilet facilities, for girls to have privacy when they were on their periods and, you know, for them to be not harassed on the way from home to school. So these were the concerns. The concerns weren't around education, whether they were religious or not. These were the concerns on the ground. The concerns were very material, and often the concerns were shared, whether they were Muslim parents or, you know, non-Muslim parents. These were the concerns with girls' education. But somehow that got translated for a lot of policymakers and for teachers as well. You know, minorities, Muslims in particular, are against education of girls. And that sort of disconnect, you know, between the perspectives of the Muslim community members and between policy makers was what got me interested. And in all of this, I never heard girls' voices myself, right? But when I began doing my research, the girls said so many interesting things in relation to being Indian citizens, being extremely aware of their context, like, you know, of the value of education, but also of the context in which they had to get that education, of, you know, of staying safe, of getting certain types of education, about social mobility. So that's where my own research sort of opened up my way of thinking about Muslim women in Muslim girls in particular, in understanding these disconnections. Where are those disconnections coming from when, you know, the people are saying this, the educational problem is this, access and how, and, you know, discrimination in the classroom, whereas the policymakers are saying this. And the girls are saying that they're aware of various issues. They're aware of patriarchal relations. They're aware of their location as Muslim minority. And so in a lot of ways, I think how I like to think about it is thinking about Muslim women in India or Muslim girl in India is a series of cross wires, as opposed to, you know, clear communication. And that's what we see in this debate, which has suddenly become a debate about whether hijab is essential to Islam, whether hijab is good or bad, or whether it's a sign of conservatism or not, when the real issue is that these girls want to go to school or college, and because of a piece of obsessorial choice, they're being excluded from educational institution. It's as simple, right? The issue at stake is really, really simple, but it's become this really huge national debate when I would have thought the colleges would, or the institutions would themselves had, you know, would have taken a stance and put an end to it.
The Sachar Committee report has something to say about the crossed wires that Dr. Sabha is talking about. Here's what it says.
There is also a common belief that Muslim parents feel that education is not important for girls and that it may instill a wrong set of values. Even if girls are enrolled, they are withdrawn at an early age to marry them off. This leads to higher drop rate among Muslim girls. Our interactions indicate that the problem may lie in the non-availability of schools within easy reach for girls at lower level of education, absence of girls' hostels, absence of female teachers, and availability of scholarships as they move up the education ladder.
The High Court is basically talking, basically one of the questions that it is examining is whether hijab is a religious garment at all. And you know, you were talking about whether, how you think that it's not an important question here, but there are some quarters of, you know, in fact, liberal Muslims who are saying that, you know, this is not, they don't feel that the constitutional argument works here because hijab is not an essential garment, and they also see it as a sign of, you know, conservatism, etc. Right? Can you just bring in your thoughts here on this, now that mess that has, this debate has become?
I think one of the things that we have to remember is Muslims in India are really a diverse group. So when we are saying Indian Muslims, we're talking about a really, really diverse group of people, right? We're not talking about one community. We're talking about many communities within that, you know, community that we broadly call Indian Muslims. But, you know, they have different cultural practices, lots of those things are dependent on, you know, which group you're talking about. And therefore, ceremonial practices, that is where, whether they wear a hijab or not, is really, really, really diverse across the country, let alone in a single community. So, I mean, in my own research, again, you know, dressing comes up, Muslim women's dressing, every time you're talking Muslim women, as though that is such an important aspect of Muslim women's identity, it keeps coming up. And even in my research, people talked about it. And one thing I saw as a researcher on the ground was that dressing practices for Muslim girls are very diverse in Assam itself, and let alone, you know, between Assam and other states and between different geographical contexts. So just to give you an example, you would have Muslim girls who go to school that don't veil whatsoever, don't veil at all, have never veiled. There are Muslim girls who would wear a hijab. There are Muslim girls who would wear a burqa. There are also Muslim women in many parts of the country that would wear a niqab, which is the full face veiling. So the, and again, as I said, there is also women that don't wear veils. So to reduce Islam to just veiling practices, or Indian Muslim women to just their veiling practices, I think it's a very, very limiting view. And there is a whole range of practices that depend on their local community, their, you know, the local practices and so on. So I think to just reduce whether hijab is important, you know, is a religious garment at all, it's a really reductive argument. Whereas the argument here is, what are we doing for these girls, a group of population that such a committee identified as the most disadvantaged in India as far as education goes? What are we doing for, you know, to ease access of education and improve educational outcomes for this group, instead of debating whether this is essential or not? And just to give you an example, again, from my own fieldwork, in my research, I met with this lovely, lovely teacher. I think she was a maths teacher in a government school in Assam. And, you know, I was in her school for several weeks. So in the process, we got to know each other. And I also interviewed her, obviously, in my research. And one of the things that she said to me, which was really interesting, is she'd been teaching in the school for about 20, 25 years. So she's a very senior, you know, well-loved member of that school community. And a few years before I'd interviewed her, her husband had passed away a couple of years, I think, before the interview. And she said when her husband passed away, she rediscovered her relationship with religion, her, you know, she found solace in religion and so on. And she changed her dressing practices from being a woman that did not wear a headscarf. She started wearing a hijab as a part of her attire with her usual sari or whatever else she was wearing. She started wearing a hijab. Now, this particular teacher was also the scouts and guides leader in the school. And she went and told her principal, the school principal, that, well, I can't do this part of my job now because, you know, Scouts and Guides has uniform, this particular set uniform, and I have started wearing a hijab, so I don't think, you know, I can follow the uniform. And the principal said to her, look, you know, that's your, whatever you're doing is up to you. But as long as you wear as a part of your, you know, belief, if you want to wear a hijab, if you wear something that goes with the uniform, I don't have a problem. And this woman carried on, this teacher carried on being the Scouts and Guides leader. And she was very, very grateful that her colleagues and the institution supported her personal decision. And it wasn't just about her identity as a Muslim woman. It was also a personal journey of discovering, you know, her evolving relationship with her faith, in her personal circumstances, etc., in which she felt supported by her colleagues. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a discussion about whether hijab is essential to you or not. It was a discussion about, would you need to do your job in the best possible way? Okay, we will make that adjustment. So I thought it was, you know, as simple as that. And therefore, you know, these practices have been going on. Muslim women have been working, going to educational institutions and so on. But, you know, all of a sudden, therefore, for these girls as well, if you've looked at any of the material, they often talk about, well, we've been in the college for a while. Why has it come, you know, this sudden change of rule being imposed all of a sudden? So I think the discussion shouldn't at all be about hijab. And that's what I'm worried about, that this discussion will become a discussion of what is Islam and, you know, what is, you know, and a lot of men and, you know, religious leader will come into the discussion and voices of these girls will get hidden and invisibilized as usual, when this was about their education and them having access to their education. So I really don't, you know, see that we will have any fruitful pathway into girls' education by talking about their dressing practices.
I also want to know if in your research, like, did you see any such kind of accommodations being made for girls, particularly because, you know, girl education is so important and, you know, we want to ensure that girls come to school?
Well, in the classroom context, I did not see any accommodations, largely because, you know, as I said, veiling is such a mixed thing. So in the same classroom, you can have three Muslim girls, one of which veils, two others don't. Or, you know, two of them veil and one doesn't. And, you know, so that itself is so diverse, that practice, to make accommodations, to treat it as anything more than wearing a sari or wearing a shalwar kameez is, to me, a waste of time. So in the classroom context, as a veiling woman or a veiling girl, sorry, in a classroom context, I haven't seen any accommodations. And I don't think any accommodation is needed. It's a piece of cloth. It's like saying, what accommodation would someone need if they were to wear a sari to school?
No, I guess, I mean, when it comes to a uniform, for instance, I mean, everyone has, you have like a sort of uniform and people assume that you have to go by that.
You know, I know what you're asking in terms of their uniform, but I haven't seen that debate playing out in the way it's playing out now, because it has been very individualized in my experience. It's been very individualized. So you could even have in a family, two sisters, one veils, one doesn't. So, you know, there hasn't been any sort of wide ranging debate about, you know, what accommodations do veiled Muslim girls need. But if you ask me what accommodations do Muslim girls need and what has been done, I would say things like, you know, because when we say Muslim girls, and again, pointing to the Sacha Committee report, it shows that, you know, Muslims have are disproportionately represented in socioeconomically marginal sections in the country. So a lot of the, you know, policies, etc., that are needed to bring improve Muslim girls' access to education are going to be economic policies, right? And that's the thing people talk about, as I said before, is in terms of access to education. And when they go to school, if the school has teachers, if the school has toilets, if it's safe. And the other thing that concerns a lot of, you know, Muslims that I have met in my experience is that of how their students are treated, if they're called names, if they're discriminated against, because a lot of Muslims in the classroom, again, experience discrimination because of their religion, right? They're, as you would know, in the classroom, a lot of the times they're called names. Quite often their affiliation and their Indianness is challenged. So a lot of that, quite often what they bring in their lunchbox, in their dabbas, is questioned, you know, as to what are you eating, or don't eat with me. And that sort of, you know, those sorts of attitudes. So those are the things that we need to talk about, as opposed to a piece of garment. That would be my, because as I said, in the case of that teacher, those accommodations have historically been made whenever the school wants to make those accommodations. And if you look at other countries, whether it's in the UK or other Western countries, they've made accommodations to, say, police uniform and, you know, firefighters uniform to accommodate, you know, women that want to dress a particular way. So the question is not about really what the, you know, as I keep saying, the question is about what can we do that would facilitate better access and better outcomes. And if it requires making accommodations within the uniform, as in many countries in the West they have been able to do, then so be it. But the question is, are we, you know, is that, does that allow them to be in the classroom?
I think what you are trying to also say is that when you sort of have a rule, it becomes very set in stone. And, you know, these are things that people are doing in a very individualized way. From what you said, I'm understanding is that you're more comfortable with something like that than some rule that is set in stone, right? I mean, that's what I understood.
What I'm saying is, you know, it's in terms of uniform, the question to be asked is if, you know, what do my students need for them to be in education, right? And historically, yes, they have, you know, there hasn't been a rule because, again, constitutionally, you know, there is freedom of religion and all of that. So there hasn't been a set rule as to this is what uniforms going to be in our schools. So Sikh boys, for example, can wear a turban and we've accepted it as, you know, that's given, right? So similarly, some Muslim girls would like to wear a headscarf and some wouldn't. So in that context, having a set uniform to say that, oh, certain things cannot now be allowed in the uniform, I think can be exclusionary for certain groups.
So the debates that people, you know, right now, people, the way we are talking about, you know, it sounds very much very French. You know, like this, the state and the church are completely divided, and that's the meaning of secularism. And you know, we are, at least, I mean, the way we have been secular is not the same. So, and I've seen that you've written about EU and, you know, these bans, etc. Like, and what do you feel about the arguments that you're hearing from, especially from the right wing, which sounds so close to what these European arguments were?
It's still very one-sided, isn't it? And the thing is, the European arguments have also been heavily critiqued to say that, so for to take the example of France, so in theory, France has this divide between the church and the state, and therefore, as far as your religion is your private matter, and therefore, as far as your public life is concerned, you can't be religious. So the state is equally distant from all religions, right? Whereas the Indian model is about the state respects all religions equally, right? So in the French model, theoretically, obviously, the state doesn't like any religion, whereas the Indian model is about it likes all of them equally, if you think about it colloquially. But the French model has been critiqued again for how deeply exclusionary it is for people, for its recent immigrants, people that are already marginal in their society, given their socioeconomic status, their minority status, and their racial experiences. So these are already heavily minoritized, marginalized groups. And then to have, you know, this sort of draconian almost, you know, secularism by stealth, it only then helps to exclude these people further. So for me, always the question, the fundamental question to ask is that measure going to be inclusive or not, right? Is it going to, you know, help? Again, as I say, with the hijab as well, the question is not about, you know, whether we support hijab or not. What we need to be supportive of is women making their own choices. So in context, let's say, like Iran, where hijab is mandatory, or Saudi, we have to support women's rights to say no to it. In context where, you know, the state requires or the powers requires women to take off, forcefully take off their hijabs, whether it is in France, whether it is in Turkey, then we have to support women's rights to wear the hijab. So it's not a question of whether they should be allowed to wear or whether this is good or bad. It's the question of women's equality and women's right to choose for themselves. And so the question any policy or any program must ask, does it help the group I'm talking about? Does it help them claim equality? Does it treat them as equal?
Could you also tell, speak a little bit about, you know, your research, especially when it comes to, you know, Muslim girls and public spaces and how they are perceived, a little bit more in detail about, you know, what the perceptions are about Muslim girls who are basically going to school?
So when we talk about Muslim girls, I think the big issue becomes that anything about Muslim women or girls is not really about them. It is about the wider political significance of it, you know. So Muslim girls or Muslim women can't seem to have an individualized life. So whether they, if they choose to wear a hijab, there is a value attached to it, not in the way any other clothing garment has a value. So hijab, there is this, you know, oversimplified notion about, oh yeah, hijab equal conservatism. Which is just a sartorial choice. So I think what is really, really, Muslim women across the world, and it's not unique to India, find themselves in a situation where they are more than just individuals. They seem to imply something about the community, right? So they seem to imply something about the community's conservativeness and so on. So for Muslim women to be seen as empowered or agential, it's as though they have to fight. They have to be seen as being against their communities and fighting against their communities. And that's when they're, you know, they're viewed as, oh, okay, that's an empowered Muslim woman because she's fighting with Muslim patriarchy. But any other women that experience, you know, discrimination and so on account of their Muslim identity, as being for being Muslim, for wearing a headscarf, or being, you know, visibly Muslim, they're not seen as empowered because their experiences of, you know, dealing with these sorts of marginalizations are not seen as empowering and so on. So I think there's a very set parameter as for Muslim girls and women to be seen as empowered and agential, and it's very, very limited and limiting for them. So that's why when you say talk about Muslim girls in public spaces, I think there is this, idea of really limiting and really dangerous idea of Muslim women being associated with just the hijab. Muslim women across the country wear different kinds of clothes, you know, have different types of cultural values, but then they're often reduced to this one thing. So in just to give you an example, in one of my schools in my research, when I asked the teachers about, you know, what's the difference between Muslim girls and others, and the teacher said, oh yeah, Muslim girls wear burqa. And in that school, I had spent weeks in that school, the Muslim girls were not wearing burqa. Quite often, both Muslim and non-Muslim girls will cover their head and their face on the way they're walking from home. And as you know, in India, the sort of street harassments women face, women prefer, for safety or anonymity, whatever it is, they prefer to stay anonymous and so on. So on their way from home to school, quite often, most of the girls in that school would, because they thought that they were, you know, passing through a rough area while coming into school. So they'd cover their faces. And when they're in school, they'll take it off. And I've seen this in other parts of the country as well. Muslim women veiling very contextually, right? So using particular garments when they're on their way from home to educational institutions or workplaces, and then taking them off there. So, but then these are all contextual and everyday choices, you know, women and girls make. But to reduce them just to that piece of clothing and to say, oh, this woman who does this is disempowered and that other woman who doesn't do it is empowered, I think it's really reductive and really dangerous way of looking at Muslim women.
What is the consequence of this kind of debate and, the way, you know, these girls have been made to feel unsafe and, you know, intimidation, etc. What could be the consequence of this kind of politicization of, this problem? And there was also someone who told me is that, you know, now it won't stop at hijab, right? So now they will, like, whatever the High Court says, even if the High Court allows hijab, you know, then, you know, maybe like the Hindu groups will decide to wear saffron and it'll become this very, very, you know, divided sort of atmosphere. It's not good for education in general. I mean, what do you think can be the consequences of something like this?
Nothing really good. And as you've said, you know, something like this, which divides people on the basis of what they wear, is pretty much dividing your classroom into, well, this is the corner where all the Muslims sit. And that's something, again, is happening in classrooms where the, you know, some in some of the colleges where the girls have been allowed to go back, but they have to sit separately. Right. So this will be furthering the social fissures that we're seeing at the minute, where there is so much fear and distrust of the other. So from having classrooms where they all learn together, you potentially have classrooms that where they're all, you know, into their own little groups, identity groups. The Muslims sit together, others sit together. And, you know, that's a really, really dangerous thing to happen. But politically speaking, that again, you know, gives this one singular message to Muslim girls that you're not welcome in education. And what you wear, we're not thinking about what other people wear, but what you wear is an issue. So, you know, your personal decision of wearing a headscarf or not is a political issue, although it's not a, you know, other people's clothes are not political issues, but yours is. So imagine being a young woman having to carry that sort of a political burden on their shoulders. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it's educational consequences are not going to be great, and it's not doing any service to Muslim women, improving Muslim women's education and Muslim girls' education.
Right. If there's anything you want to add to this,
No, I think I've already said this, but I'll still repeat it. So the first thing is that we, as people who are watching this and talking about Muslim women and hijabi Muslim girls and whether they, you know, and their education, what we should be, the ethic or the, you know, the rule we should all be following is support women's choices. If that choice is to wear a hijab, support it. If the choice is to not wear a hijab, support it. But the thing to do is support women making choices. And the next thing, what I think I want to finish on a slightly optimistic note, and you might have seen these images in the newspaper as well, of, you know, girls, Muslim girls and non-Muslim girls walking together, hijab-wearing Muslim girls and others walking together to school, holding hands. And one of the things in the early days of this, I was wondering, where are the classmates? They must have friends. They must, you know, if they're going to school at that college for years, they must have friends. They must have their own, you know, networks. Where are those people? And then when those images emerged, I think yesterday, of, you know, girls were walking together, different girls wearing the school uniform, some wearing a hijab, some not, was a source of hope to think that, yes, there is this wider politics, but then also there are these personal friendships and relationships and solidarities, which will potentially, you know, overcome all of the prejudice and all of the hate, hopefully.
Right. Yeah, I hope you're right.
Yeah, I know. That's the hope.
Please rate our podcast and leave a comment if you like it. Underreported and underrepresented stories can become mainstream only if it reaches more people. So please support us by visiting a contributing page on our website, sunoindia.in, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.